Hi, morning, Tammy. Welcome to Assessment for All Learners. This is our inaugural podcast. So maybe we can start off with you introducing yourself.
Oh, hello, Hoyoung. Thank you for having me. My name is Tanmay, and I'm an assistant professor at the Learning Sciences and Assessment Department here at the National Institute of Education. And I'm interested in the role of emotions in learning through problem solving and how we can design technology and teacher-oriented scaffolds for better emotion regulation.
One of the things, interestingly, is you were PhD student of Professor Manu Kapoor, who was my former boss in a previous department. And I remember being very intrigued when he talked about productive failure. You know, here in Singapore, we are always emphasizing success, and teachers are always very focused on the performance of the students. So it came as an intriguing idea of this whole purposely designing for failure. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about this idea of productive failure.
All right. So as I said, I do work on learning through problem solving. And productive failure is one way to design for that problem solving intentionally in a way that exposes students to initial failures before they actually receive a lecture on that topic. So it's one way of learning through problem solving. And in that approach, we try to build on students' prior knowledge as they try to come into a class. And the real idea is to prepare them to learn from the lecture better. So the assumption is that students as novices may not necessarily have the prior knowledge and experience of the experts. And so when we try to teach them, you know, a complex topic, they may often not be well prepared to understand the intricacies of that topic. And so can we create active student experiences? And can we use that to create a time for telling, which is the instruction or the lecture? So that's the basic idea of productive failure. And the failure here is really something that is intentionally designed for, because students have not learned the concept yet. When they come and they try out different approaches to solve a problem, they inevitably don't reach the canonical answer. So that's the failure component here. But again, there's no scaffold that leads students to failure. It's really only the design of the problem that makes students work with suboptimal solutions. And again, not all students may fail. But across the majority of productive failure studies, what we have seen is that, you know, typically around 70, 80, 90% of students do not succeed canonically at the task.
Thanks for explaining that. So one of the things teachers might push back is that students on encountering that failure will give up because they were intrinsically not motivated anyway. So what is your response to such teachers' opinion?
I think that's a great question, and I think this is something that comes up very frequently in designing for failure-driven problem solving. I think it's not just the design of the problem, but it's also the social surround in the classroom that is important. So often students may not work individually when they go through failure-driven problem solving. They often work in groups, right? So that's one mechanism. I think the other form of support, which is equally important, is the sociocultural norm in the classroom. So if we have classrooms that value failure, that normalize learning from mistakes, then students are more likely to be okay with generating multiple ideas and not thinking really of the accuracy of those ideas, at least initially, right? So I think it's really about setting the appropriate norms in the classroom. And I think that's also one of the characteristics of high-performing classrooms. It's not just about the learning design or the pedagogy, but it's about where that pedagogy is situated in the classroom.
So on that point about pedagogy, what would teachers need to learn to redo or do differently in the design of such a lesson?
So I think one way of thinking about the productive failure pedagogy is that it really involves a lot of work in redesigning the lesson, But actually, that may not be the case. The one way to rethink of how we design for productive failure is that we just want to delay when we do instruction. So if you look at direct instruction, what we typically do as teachers is that we introduce concepts and then we allow students some space to do problem solving via practice, right? So the instruction piece comes first in the traditional way that we teach. In productive failure, we really flip that sequence. So we are not saying that, you know, we should engage students in open-ended discovery and then just leave them in the waters. We're just trying to delay the instruction and create some time where students can actually experience different parts of the concept themselves first. So in that sense, the redesign comes in two parts, I would say. One is to withhold, you know, the enthusiasm of really telling students what the right approach is as soon as you go into the classroom, right? So this is more of a mindset shift, I would say. And then I think the other piece is to design the open-ended problem that students work on initially. So again, you may not want to just give students a practice problem first. That's not the idea. You want to design the problem in a way that admits multiple solutions. So it should be fairly open-ended, but it should still have a concrete goal. And again, most importantly, I think this problem should build on what students already know. So for example, if you're teaching a concept of, let's say, standard deviation in mathematics, you do want students to know things like central tendencies. You do want students to know things like, you know, graphing and some prerequisite knowledge that is required before learning standard deviation. So the key idea of the redesign is to activate students' prerequisite knowledge, but make the problem unsolvable by that prerequisite knowledge. And that is where students begin to fail. So I think that's the key idea behind the problem design. Now, when we come to the instruction, there's also a design piece that is important here, and that's a critical component of productive failure. During the lecture, we don't just want to give students the right answer. We actually want to relate common wrong ways of solving the problem or common suboptimal ways of solving the problem with the right answer. So we call this instruction that builds on student solutions, because we don't want to leave students' ideas as they are and say, oh, by the way, this is the way to solve the problem. We do want to link what they have done with the right answer. And the goal behind this, I think, is to make students aware of their knowledge gaps, what they don't know. Right. So those are the two, I think, big pieces of the redesign. One is focusing on the design of the problem itself, which admits multiple solutions. And the other is designing instruction that builds on student solutions.
So thanks for clarifying on that. I do remember earlier on when Professor Manukappa was doing this, he had a lot of pushback from teachers because even as you are mentioning how in the redesign, they found that very effortful. For example, they might have a deck of slides to explain the concept already, but now they will have to think about how to relate the students' answers and pointing out their gaps and relating it to what they had already prepared to teach. So I guess perhaps the teachers would be asking and wondering by this point, what's in it for me? Would there be evidence of success? So what would you tell them? Have you seen evidence of success through this approach?
Yeah, so I think that's a very important question. I think in the learning sciences, we don't just want to make predictions, but we also want to test them systematically in controlled studies. And in fact, in a meta study, so a study that compared many studies across the world that implemented productive failure or problem solving before instruction and compared that to a typical instruction first approach, found that if we compare the effects, this effect is about 3 times stronger compared to the impact of a high performing teacher on a classroom at the end of classroom year. So in some sense, this is not just an incremental effect, because there's several components that go into, you know, predicting this kind of an effect. So yes, we do have empirical evidence for studies conducted across the world, you know, both Asia, Europe, but also the US.
So given the success that you have just sketched out with regards to problem solving before instruction, are there other ways of improving upon this design?
So I think in recent years, there has been some work on trying to make failure-driven problem solving even more optimal in terms of learning. So in the typical productive failure design, we rely on students spontaneously achieving failures in some sense before they come to a lecture. One way to design differently is to actually make students work with solutions which we know are not the right solutions. But again, of course, we do this before instruction. The goal there would be to make students explore different parts of the problem space so that they become aware of what are the boundary conditions of different solutions. And then this can prepare them even better when they go to a lecture to learn the canonical idea. So one can think of this in terms of guided failure in some way. So instead of just asking students to come up with as many solutions as they could to an open-ended task, we also give them specific, plausible, suboptimal solutions. And we ask them to generate it and work with it and reason with it and critique it. And in the process, we expect that students become aware of, you know, the different parts of the problem and solution space. So that's one way to talk about it. So as an example, earlier I talked about teaching standard deviation. So in the context of teaching standard deviation, a suboptimal solution could be looking at difference between sequential data points as opposed to looking at differences from the central point. So in the canonical idea of standard deviation, we always take differences from the mean value or the central value. But one typical suboptimal solution that students come up with is that they often take differences between sequential data points as a way to look at deviations, but not from a central point. So that is a suboptimal solution. So in guided failure, we could actually ask students to come up with this solution intentionally and deliberately as a way for them to realize the limitations of taking differences between sequential data points. So that's guided failure. It's failure because we know that differences between sequential data points is a failed or a suboptimal solution with respect to the correct solution of standard deviation. So another alternative to productive failure and guided failure would be something that we call vicarious failure. So this is a design where students don't generate them, you know, solutions themselves, but they just read or evaluate somebody else's solution, meaning they're trying to learn vicariously from others' failed or suboptimal solutions. So that's a third design. And in this design, of course, you can imagine that students would have probably less cognitive load because they don't have to actively generate solutions on a new topic themselves. But then they do have to read and critique somebody else's failed solution. And again, teachers can design for this before the lecture as a preparatory activity, as an alternative to actually making students solve problems themselves. So this is more of a read, evaluate, explain, critique kind of a design, as opposed to generate.
Thank you, Tammy. So this has been fascinating knowing about this as pedagogical approaches, but how did you come about to learn of all this or be involved in researching this?
So I think one of the questions that I started with as I enter into the productive failure paradigm was to ask if it's really failure that leads to learning. Because when students do problem solving before instruction, there are many other learning mechanisms at play that could drive the learning effects. We didn't really know if it was failure in particular, students failing to come up with the correct solutions, whether it was that which led to, you know, higher order learning effects. So I started with that very simple question. And in one of the first few designs that I compared productive failure with. I tried to investigate if making students fail deliberately would actually improve learning even more than just engaging in free generation of solutions. So I think the very first question for me was, does failure causally lead to improved learning? We didn't know that. And so that's how I developed this design of guided failure, where we do ask students to come up freely with multiple solutions, but then we complement that with giving them specific suboptimal solutions to generate and work with, which we know will lead to failure by design. So when I transitioned into the design of guided failure, until then, a lot of the work in this field had focused on the cognitive mechanisms for why this design works. So a lot of the studies talked about the fact that these designs help students activate their prior knowledge. They help students become aware of the gaps in their knowledge. And that's why, you know, students were more prepared to learn in the follow-up lecture. There wasn't a lot of emphasis on what was happening emotionally as students went through these designs that focused on failure. I mean, we can imagine that students, when they try to solve problems on a concept they haven't learned yet, that will inevitably lead them to frustrating experiences. That will inevitably lead them to experiences of shame, anger. And so that's when I started digging more into what's happening at the emotional level when students go through this kind of a problem-solving phase. Because of course, this problem-solving is very different from problem-solving as practice, which we often do as teachers, right? So when you know the concept and then you engage in problem-solving, the emotional profile is very, very different than if you engage in problems first. And so that led me to, you know, start research into the role of emotions in these designs that focus on failure in particular. And in some sense, I think this mirrors our problem-solving experiences also in daily lives, because we often work on new problems. We often don't know the solutions to problems that we try to attempt. And again, as we engage through this process of problem solving, it's not always a comfortable experience. So we needed to better understand whether and how this discomfort drives learning. Because we know that there are these learning effects from meta studies that I talked about earlier. But we better want to understand why we have these effects and what is the role of this kind of emotional discomfort in driving these learning effects.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting point about how certain emotions in general, can drive learning. So can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
So learning comes with emotions, right? All of us can recall a time where we felt satisfied after solving a problem or shame at feeling stuck. And again, as parents and teachers, in difficult learning moments, we often try to encourage learners to, you know, push aside emotions that are negative. And again, the popular belief is that it's actually preferable to have more positive emotions while learning. How I think of emotions, especially in failure-focused problem-solving context, is that we may better want to view it as a Swiss Army knife. Each emotion that appears during the initial problem solving has its purpose. And as parents and educators and teachers, we need to recognize how negative emotions can help learners achieve their task goals and grow, not hurt them. So for example, in studies with guided failure and productive failure, what I've found is that emotions like anger and shame are actually positively related or correlated to the kind of solutions that students develop. And emotions like happiness, which are pleasurable, are actually negatively correlated to learning, meaning that the more happy students feel, the lower they perform at the post-test. Now, this is a very counterintuitive result. And what this suggests to us is that emotions can serve as a double-edged sword. Pleasurable emotions like happiness, for example, can often be an indicator of complacency, right? Because they don't push learners to engage meaningfully in a learning experience. Shame and anger, on the other hand, are confrontational. They trigger change. They can sometimes serve as a motivator to push students forward to improve their self-image by trying out other ideas that may work during the problem-solving process, right? So I think that's one way in which emotions, even though discomforting, can improve or have good effects for learning.
Thanks, Tammy, for bringing that up. I really like the metaphor of the Swiss Army knife. But I imagine teachers listening in would be asking, so what are some strategies, some quick takeaways that I would need to practice in my classroom?
I think that's a very important point. As we design environments for learning, actually thinking of what teachers could do in classrooms is very, very important. And I think that's very intrinsic to learning sciences, the field of learning sciences. I think here are some ways in which teachers can help students grow through, including negative emotions in moderation. I think one of the ideas is to change learners' perspectives on negative emotions. So as a teacher, for example, you could encourage sharing and building support systems. And, you know, one can get started with something as simple as actually making space for students to engage with these emotional experiences and asking something like, you know, what's something that made you upset when you're trying to solve this problem? Let's talk about it together. I'm here to listen and help you work through them, right? So the emphasis in the initial problem-solving phase is not to give students the correct answers, but it's really to manage their cognitive load and their emotions. So that's one concrete strategy. The other component is to validate and normalize those emotions, right? So for example, as a teacher, you may say, it sounds like you really felt disappointed when you were not able to get the right answer. I can see why you felt that way. Learning can be tough. It's hard when things don't go as we hope, right? Or it's completely normal to feel frustrated or embarrassed when learning something new. It shows that you actually care about doing well. So I think these are some ways in which this idea of normalizing emotions that are unpleasurable or emotions that are discomfort or that give you discomfort, right, can actually help students recognize the importance of those emotions. And I think the most crucial piece, I think the third strategy then, would be to reframe the meaning of that emotion and setting goals collaboratively. So as a teacher, for example, you could say, instead of letting that shame, for example, hold you back, how can we use that feeling to motivate you to try again? Let's set a small goal to work on. What's one thing that you would like to improve before going into a lecture? Right? So I think in general, the idea is to have these empathetic conversations with students, either during the initial problem-solving phase or after students have gone through that initial problem-solving phase, to acknowledge and validate and normalize these unpleasurable emotions that occur during the learning process and make students realize that it's completely normal, right? So I think that's something that teachers could do in classrooms.
Thank you, Tammy. I've learned so much this morning. I mean, two main takeaways. Number one, the whole idea of productive failure is not about doing away with instruction. Instruction still stays there, but it's the idea of delaying it while students get an opportunity to play with their ideas, to experience being engaging in the problem space. Secondly, is about the emotions that it is not necessarily bad that they experience negative emotions, and these negative emotions can be even a driver for learning. What would be some other things that you think I should keep in mind as, or our readers should keep in mind as well on this topic?
I think you brought up an important point about negative emotions as drivers of learning. I mean, let me clarify something before I continue. The goal is never to intentionally cause learners to feel bad about themselves when they struggle during problem solving. It is to see negative emotions as a tool in a diverse toolbox of problem solving or learning strategies that can be included and built upon during the learning process. When we allow students to grow in learning situations with high likelihood of failure, they have the opportunity to learn, to manage, and soldier through negative emotions that inevitably come. This mirrors everyday life. So the next time, as a teacher, if you find yourself wanting to say brush it off and let's focus on the positives when learners hit a roadblock, take a step back. Know your learner. Think about whether it may be helpful to guide them to cultivate the negative emotion and reach their goals. You might just turn the situation into an opportunity for positive change.
Right. Thank you, Tanmay. It has been a delightful conversation and I'm sure a lot of food for thought for our teachers. Thank you again.
Thanks again, Huyong, for having me. I think it's been a real pleasure talking to our teacher colleagues here in Singapore and to everyone who's listening. Thank you again.